is up, ladies and gentlemen? Welcome back to Fudge Muppet. My name is Scott, and I am here with Michael and Drew, as always, for the Elder Scrolls podcast. Today's episode is all about the Elysian Empire, the very first empire of Cyrodiil, of men. Anyway, which one of you is going to start us off? Well, let's get going with how it all begins, like the conception, the Elysian Slave Rebellion.
Take it away, Drew.
All right, well, the Elysians. God, where to start on the Elysians?
Let's start with Elysia herself, the namesake of the Empire.
Okay, well, she goes by many names. Mm-hmm. You hear Perif, Paravania, Alesh, which means highest or high something. Mm. Which I should probably have looked up before, but gets messed around with, becomes Elysia. But basically, the Aelids were not the nicest people. You know, they were building their empire on the backs of Nedic slaves. And Elysia, you know what, she said, I've had enough of this. So she tried to get in contact with Akatosh and the gods to try and turn it around. And she turned it around.
Damn straight.
Yeah.
Solid. That's it. Solid. Podcast done. Congratulations.
That's it in a nutshell right there.
Yeah. So we have Elysia, and she has her... I can't even remember if it was a vision or she contacted. There's different stories about it too. But Akatosh. But basically the Divines send her some champions as well. So she was born in Sadavar Lead, which mm-hmm. is one of the Aelid settlements. And she sort of starts this rebellion in 242 of the First Era.
Yep.
And basically, Pelennor Whitestreck comes and joins the party. So does the legendary Manbull, son of Kyne, Morrowhouse. And also, at the same time, the Skyrim conquests had sort of been going on, and Raga the Gifted sort of gifted a bunch of his Nordic armies to help emancipate the Nedic slaves as well, which they needed. So there's some interesting bits and pieces about, like, the mythology is awesome, this part, like the songs of Pelennor. You hear all through Pelennor Whitestreak killing these Aelid kings, and it's pretty awesome. But I'm interested to hear your guys' thoughts on this, because I always imagine this period as very, like, ancient-looking in terms of... The two pieces of evidence for this are in the Songs of Pelennor, where they refer to Pelennor's lover, Huna, the Hoplite. And a Hoplite is, you know, a heavily armored infantry from ancient Greece. Yeah. So you imagine, like, the shield and spear and stuff like that, which innately already is, like, a... You know, gives you a feeling of an older time. And then also they refer to Pelennor's armor as from a future time, and what he's wearing is like a 12th or 13th century sort of like crusader armor. And so just with those pieces of evidence, I like to imagine, like, they're all around jungle Cyrodiil, but like Greek hoplite kind of things and different. And if you think about it even more, like Rome borrowed in our real world, borrowed a lot from Greece, and a lot of, like, you know, their pantheon, their legends, stuff like that. Like, you know, you've got Achilles becoming Ulysses and stuff like that. So in a similar way, you can kind of see the more like Roman motifs of the future being built off the sort of Greek motifs of the older stuff. And I mean, if you take a more Byzantine approach to the modern empires, it's kind of a good combination of Latin and Greek. But yeah, I don't know. I like to imagine it as all that sort of like, kind of like that 5th century BC. What do you guys think?
Well, the way the Aelids are described as well seems very, not necessarily primitive, but also very divergent from the way elves were. You know, like if you imagine this as a very jungled Cyrodiil, and you see them described as having feathers and magic beads adorning their armor and stuff. So even the Aelids feel very ancient, even though they come from this high Ulma culture.
Yeah, I think it's... Maybe we should actually... I mean, well, this is the tiniest divergence. We'll try and keep it tight. But there is the concept that there has been a regression in like technology or magical or like heights of civilization since the earlier times. And in some aspects, that is true. But it's not, I think, it's not a linear progression. In some ways, I think it's reasonable to assume that the more modern Elder Scrolls societies and so on in Tamriel have advanced in some ways, but have regressed in other ways in the way that they're more distanced from magic and mythology and stuff. So Because a lot of people, I've seen arguments and stuff before about people going like, oh, the hoplite thing. They don't think they were like, there's no Bronze Age or Iron Age, which is true. But I still feel like the early ones had like an ancient feeling. Because I guess to the Bronze and Iron Age stuff, they'll say that because of the nature of kalpas and things carrying over and all the different materials and stuff, that are available, like you're not necessarily just going to have a...
I always associate it with the sundering. So the idea that the elves were sundered, they were once this united, very, like descendant from the Aedra, that's very pronounced. But the sundering where various offshoots go around Tamriel, and then even when Alicia is talking to Kyne's handmaiden, so probably Mara, we assume is who she was speaking to, there's mention of another sundering to sunder the Aelids. So it's like, is the idea that the more the elves get sundered, the further they diverge from this, ancient, much more sophisticated culture.
Yeah.
And that's kind of what the Altmer are always trying to hold on to.
Yeah, falling from gods kind of thing.
It could be. I can definitely see it being a bit of a parallel to the real world as well when you look at medieval times versus ancient times. Mm-hmm. And you can kind of see that in some ways medieval times had some more advanced stuff, but a lot of the time they had less advanced things. You could look back at ancient societies who had much better setups or better understandings of astrology, which you could almost parallel to magic in the Elder Scrolls universe specifically. But it tends to be a theme across all of the Elder Scrolls. The ancient societies were far more advanced, so it wouldn't surprise me. Another thing that I wanted to say as well, with the Nibbanese culture, is it canon that they kind of wore like more beads and different things, and they were a bit more
later Nibbanese culture was described as very like not vain's not the right word, but very like aesthetically driven, lots of like tattoos and different things, lots of mini cults, and like there's just a lot of aesthetic variation, whereas compared to the Clovians, who are a bit more uniform.
Was
and
it
practical.
A bit, could you say it's a little bit Venetian?
Oh yeah, the imperial city for sure.
Yeah,
definitely was.
Anyway, I was just saying when you talk about the Aelids and them wearing beads and things like that, I wonder how much like the Nedic slaves, for example, I wonder how much they kind of got inspired with their fashion down the line.
Yeah, maybe.
Well, I mean, like drawing back to what you were saying about the idea that, kind of like in the real world, it almost seems like in ancient times, some of these great powers had things more figured out. It's like I've researched a lot into how the Romans settled in Britain. And a lot of the times, like the further the empire stretches, the further you reach out, the further you get away from your own culture. And a lot of these Romans just ended up kind of getting assimilated into like a Britonic culture. And, you could say that about the elves in general, not necessarily that they were one uniform empire, but the more they spread out, you see them all change. And, a lot of the secrets that, say, the Sigh may be guarding just kind of get, like, forgotten or transformed and, just
the other
become
thing to
entirely
consider
different.
As well is that, like, an empire brings a big network of communication and stability and so on. And with each empire falling, you'll have... I know they call it like the Dark Ages after the Romans fell and so on, but it did leave a big vacuum where, the sort of consolidation of information and societal transfer kind of gets broken down. And like there was another collapse before in the, like, the Bronze Age collapse and stuff, whereas, there's thought that they were way more advanced and there was a big collapse. So there's many examples of historical resets, and arguably there could be same such things, after the Elysian Empire and after the Riemann Empire or things like that. But we won't...
We won't get too far into that. Getting back to Elysia. So yeah. Elysia is a slave. Her rebellion basically, until she wins, takes a good year. So I think it starts in 242 and then ends in 243?
Yeah,
and then
so the White God Tower is taken in 243.
Yeah, awesome. And then she takes over that and she kind of gets crowned the queen of this new empire. Queen Elysia. And then this is basically the first empire, and then Elysia ends up, what was I saying?
This deal with, the one thing that's special about the Elysian Empire is it, we were talking about speaking with Kyne and Mara and Akatosh, or, some say it's actually speaking with Shazar, but basically the idea is that this set in motion the traditions that are up, well, they've tried to uphold throughout the Cyrodiilic empires, of lighting the dragon fires, of wearing the amulet of kings, and keeping a dragonborn on the throne.
That's the thing too, that sort of, it's a what would the phrase be, like sanctified by God, like this, you're ordained by the gods, by the divines. So it's not just a simple, oh, I'm a king, I found a hill, I'm the king. It's the divines have ordained you with the righteous right to rule. Whether right or not, you know, the morality fluctuates throughout the emperors, but that is why only the dragonborn dynasties of Alesia, Riemann, and Septim have been recognized, and, you know, little ones in between haven't been.
Anyway, so Alesia goes on to make a new pantheon.
Yeah.
So there's the Nordic people, basically, and the Needs. And the Needs grew up around the Aelid, so they kind of have the Aelid pantheon in a way, like more elven influences that they've been used to. Yeah. As much as the Aelids were their rulers, they've also just been around the same gods. And so she kind of makes a fusion of that, being the Eight Divines.
Yeah.
Featuring a kind of mix of... both elements to create a group of gods that everyone's happy with.
Yeah, because then that's how you get like Shazar being watered down from instead of being Shor, the anti-Aldmer warlord, he becomes Shazar, which is sort of just like a spirit of human undertaking or something like that. And then you have Akatosh, who is... I wonder if early versions did sort of emphasize the dragon part so much, because Alduin was a pretty like feared figure. And if you actually think about it, like, potentially at this time, Alduin could have mainly, like, it could have happened only a few centuries ago at this point in history. So, you know, it might be a bit touchy and so on. But yeah, so they established the Eight Divines, and that's like the biggest. So basically the core spiritual touchstones of the modern day empire, the Eight Divines, the Amulet of Kings, the Dragonfires, Dragonblood Rulers, that all gets established right now. And remember, the big reason for this pact was because the Aelids used Daedra. They could summon up armies of Daedra and stuff, which were helping them, you know, suppress the Needs and, you know, do all kinds of evil things. So basically, Akatosh made this pact with Alesia that as long as one of her descendants or her descendants stay on the throne, that the... planes, but the barrier between Mundus and Oblivion would stay very solid and not allow, you know, giant armies of Daedra to be conjured up and oppress the races of men.
And that's through the lighting of the dragon fires as well, which Akatosh was also said to have given to Alesia. Yeah. And you also have to think, which is interesting, and we've talked about it in one of our podcasts before, but this whole idea that Akatosh didn't really exist at that point. Like, he did, but not in that name. And obviously, we can say gods don't work on the same linear time scale as the mortals. But it's quite interesting that, you know, Akatosh wasn't actually a god in the pantheon at the time. So when Alesia is a slave, no one's worshipping Akatosh specifically. Yeah. But then Akatosh comes to her in a vision, leads her into this rebellion. She takes over, creates a new pantheon, and then puts Akatosh in it, which is interesting. And... you know, you can get into these ideas of like the Akka Oversoul, and, you know, you have Auriel, Akatosh, Alduin, and then, you know, are they all different entities? Are they all kind of different personalities, for lack of better words, of the same entity? But either way, that entity, so the Needs would have been familiar with Auriel. The Nords, who also kind of came on in, were familiar with Alduin. Akatosh is really just a kind of midpoint in between all of that, but then is different in different ways. And then you can also get into this whole idea, is this why Akatosh is considered insane? Because it's this big contradictory deity that kind of has two heads in some depictions.
So, I mean, there's sources that suggest both, but I'm firmly of the belief that Alesia actually was in contact with Shor.
Okay.
Not necessarily Akatosh, because, you know, she was spoken to probably by Mara, who was the handmaiden for Kain, who was the wife of Shor. And the Amulet of Kings is created from a soul gem that has a drop of Lorcan's blood in it. So from when Auriel fired Lorcan's heart across Tamriel, one drop of blood spilled over Cyrodiil, and that created the Amulet of Kings, essentially. So a lot of this power actually comes from Shaw, including Pelennor, which is a massive tangent on its own. But the idea is that he's just not necessarily a Shezarine, but made from Lorcan's own blood.
Yeah. Mm. Yeah, he's there's an interesting stories with Pelennor, like, sort of started being going under all these other names, and like I think Harold Hairy Breeches is one of them, and like
he calls Morehouse his nephew as well, which is an interesting, when you think about it from the Nordic perspective of Shaw and Kyne being husband and wife.
Maybe the Shezarine. And then there are some out of Michael Kirkbride things, out of like canon things, like I think it's something when someone spoke Pelennor's true name or something, he gets submerged by ancestor moths or something. I can't remember the exact story.
So this
all starts the Empire. I think people should be pretty familiar with all of this. Like, we've talked about Pelennor and all that before. An important part here is that Morehouse becomes Alicia's lover.
Not Pelennor's lover.
No.
Alicia's Pelennor. And together they have Belaza,
yeah,
the Manvel. And this is considered by some to be the first Minotaur.
Yeah.
And other people consider, like, Morehouse to be... Like, it's hard to distinguish Morehouse and Belaza and what the difference between the two is, because some depictions of Morehouse are quite Minotaur-like. But Belaza, I would imagine, looks quite different and much more like a Minotaur, because it really is that, like, bull mixed with human kind of hybrid, at least. Belaza has to look different to Morehouse.
Yeah. But the important part of this, too, is... So Alicia rules for a bit, but... This is like a crazy time for the races of man, because Vraga the Gifted's gone and done all his Skyrim conquest, plus he's helped, you know, support the Elysian Rebellion, which has now been successful. And then also even in Hammerfell, in Northern Hammerfell, you have the Dothraki needs, which aren't necessarily, like, they could have been fully developed at that time, like, you know, but or they could have still been like on the way to getting to where they would be at the time of around like 800 or whatever it was later in this millennium. But still, like, it's a good time for humans at this point. This period is the switch which makes human dominance become a reality.
It's the age of man.
Yes.
Yeah. Well, Morefic is Nordic for era of the elves. So the first era is when it flips to men.
Right.
Yeah.
It's their turn.
So I like to imagine, like, I would love to do like an ideal, like, video game sort of setting of like the early Elysian Empire. Maybe it was when like Belhaza or something has been ruling, sort of like set just before sort of Marokan's prophecies are sort of you know, hitting, like when they're getting popular and so on, and you'll have like all like these Minotaur guards and stuff like that, and you have like the needs and their river jungle society are going up and down, like living off like rice and so on, like big crops of rice and stuff, and then you'd have also like the Aeliad vassal states and so on. But really, let's, I guess, get into... There's not a lot of information about that period. And also, interestingly, depends on... Like, there's some out-of-canon sources that kind of add some emperors. But I think we only get mention of, like, four Elysian emperors in their, like, thousands of year-long empire. So, but let's talk about the big defining element because of the Elysian Empire, because it kind of gets co-opted and... Most of the Elysian Empire is remembered for the Elysian Order. Like, it was only a couple hundred years, if that even, with the Elysian Order not being there. So we have the rise of Maruk, who is this Imgur prophet, who he received a vision from Alicia. I'll actually read it to you.
Who is dead at this point, by the way? So yes, Alicia dies.
Yes, Alicia's dead. So this is from the Illusion of Death. Then, because he had toyed with the ape maiden Dulsa, did Maruk spend the century of penance upon the stone meadows, and his sight was seared, and his tongue was swollen, and his pelt was mottled, and his left thumb pointed ever at the stars of the tower, and ever did the shade of Alesh speak to him, serrated words that rasped his concept organ, and brought him to wisdom through affliction. And he recorded her words in his simian gore with glyphs on the beseeching scarp, and the fire did... The fire and the fire in his blood did etch the lithic face with the 77 inflexible doctrines. And though the labor to the rest, we could just go blah, 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 blah. But he talks a lot of cool stuff. But the last part is reaching the one. Then did Marok know a right reaching? That one devoted to proper life and elnophic annulment shall persist beyond the illusion of death. For indeed, the drive to expunge corruption can conquer even the Archaean cycle. But
let's unpack this.
Yeah. So the Elysian Order essentially, and from basically only professors, is the only group, I think, that have ever professed monotheism. And technically, if you get into the whole Godhead thing, there kind of is only the one, like, true most powerful being above all, like what predates even Anu and Padme kind of thing.
How does it relate to a group like the Skull and the Allmaker?
I've heard other things that are like, I guess they would be called like animists or something, like seeing like all the spirits in nature and so on. And they do, the Skull do recognize like a duality anyway. They have like the adversary and they have the woodland man and stuff like that.
So are you saying that Marok basically was saying that there are no other gods? Like these are all...
No, well, he basically they're all like demoted to like spirits. And stuff. There were like
and
many
saints and stuff, right? It's kind of like there's one real God, and everything else is just like a spirit or a saint or like a lesser kind of entity.
Yeah. So
yeah, it's very focused around Akatosh.
Yeah.
You know, specifically, and I mean, just like one thing to insert there as well is it was a good idea by Elysia to try to implement elements of the elven and the human in creating the eight divines. But you know, when you've got an empire that's built on the conflict between the two races, you know, the really bloody conflict where you have to like violently remove a lot of these Aelids, the idea that you'd have a empire that follows that is half elven, half human, kind of feels like that could very easily be broken at any point by, you know, by people who will never forgive the elves, for example.
Yeah. And that quite literally happens too. Mm. So the Elysian Order kicks off. And it starts, and the empire, the doctrines, the 77 77 inflexible doctrines of Marok, they become part of the Elysian doctrines, which become sort of codified in law, politics, and religion sort of meet, and the emperors going forward kind of end up becoming like, you know, Elysian zealots like the rest of them, and there's the one above, and all that kind of stuff. So and obviously they set the infamous
you're guilty until proven innocent. Yeah.
Though to be fair, I mean, that kind of just matches up with pretty much all of human history as well until like the 17th, 18th centuries, and even today there's places that like you're guilty till proven innocent.
It must be very hard living in that system.
Yeah.
Super hard, well, especially without mobile phones. You have a huge lack of ways to prove that you are innocent. Think about it.
Yeah. I imagine in a lot of cases, when you've got a theocracy like this, so focused on God, that a lot of the times they're not even going to pay attention to your arguments of whether you're guilty or not. It's more just they're going to, you know, it's going to be prayer or like, you know, if there's any signs that you're innocent or guilty, I imagine it's just you don't really have a say at the end of it.
They need to bring back trial by cake. Eat a piece of cake and say, you know, if I'm guilty, may God strike me down. And of course it's poisoned.
Apparently there, so I'll just find the actual date for you. It's the year 361. So that is actually even under 100 years since Elysia's death, where the Elysian doctrines are enforced. And that's when they become the dominant part of political, of the Elysian Empire. So that's when they basically meet. And everything kind of goes downhill from here in ways. King, the infamous High King Borgus, he converted to the Elysian doctrines. And, you know, that's when, you know, he tried to convince the Elysian Order to join them on a conquest of Valenwood. And that's when the Wild Hunt.
Yeah, which makes total sense. You know, it's like the Nords, they never acknowledged any elven gods. Mm. So if they're going to work with the Elysians, and the Elysians are suddenly saying we want to purge all the elven elements from our empire, you know, Borgus is going to be chuffed.
Yeah, it makes me wonder if Borgus actually kind of converted for real, or if he's just a massive sellout.
Yeah,
because it'd be hard to just throw away all your like religious concepts and be like, oh, actually this other religion is true.
Hmm. Yeah. Be like that. But and then next, if we actually want to have a look at the time it took for the Aelids to start being kicked out, 361, the Elysian Doctrines are enforced. 374, the Aelid vassal state of Nenalata is massacred by the Elysian Order. So essentially the story behind that is the Elysians, you know, tolerated the Aelid vassals for a while, but then they're like, nope, you're out.
They served their purpose, and then they got rid of them.
Yeah, well, the Lelorian Dianar, he fled with a bunch of them, but whoever remained in Nenalata was massacred, basically. And the Aelids were pushed from Cyrodiil everywhere. Mm. And then later they like sack, and there's a nice, not a nice book, but there's a little book about the sacking of Malada as well, which is an Aelid temple. But basically they were just going on, I guess I kind of imagine it as like almost like crusaders kind of, but not quite. Like they might have even fashioned themselves in the image of Pelennor or something. I don't know if they had the armor technology yet to meet with that.
And a lot of the Aelids, they ran to Dureni territory, didn't they?
Yeah.
Yeah, which comes into play very soon. But it's one thing that's important to remember about Cyrodiil is, you know, like when you play Oblivion, even though it's a long time later, you think about a kind of uniform province. But it's very important to notice, you know, you've got your Aelids getting pushed out, but there's also the very distinct culture in the West of the Kelovians, which they don't really mesh too well with the Elysian Order.
Yeah, well, let's get to that. So the big story behind that, and the sort of the hero behind the sort of at least spiritual establishment of the Kelovian estates is Rislav Laric or Larich. I don't know which one. What do you guys prefer?
I just say Laric because I imagine it's kind of slightly Eastern European, I guess. And I think you'd say, yeah. I don't know, who knows?
Yeah, so Rislav the Righteous, as he later gets called.
Did we just lose Michael?
We've lost Michael.
Anyway, so the story of Rislav Laric is basically he lives in Skingrad. He has a brother, Dorald, who is a priest of Maruk, who is off being a priest and therefore survives a plague that comes through and kills most of the city. Now, their father is the king of Skingrad, so the father gets killed, which means no one's on the throne. And then Dorald comes back basically to sit on the throne. He wants to be king. And there's basically rumors that he's going to cede Skingrad straight to the empire. And his brother is Rislav and he doesn't want this. And so he basically comes and kills him. So there's a cool quote. The brothers faced one another in the castle courtyard where they had grown up. In typical Kelovian fashion, there was no trial, no accusations of treason, no jury, no judge, only an executioner. Thou art no brother of mine, Rislav Laric said, and struck Dorald's head from his shoulders in one blow. He was crowned king of Skingrad, still holding the same bloody axe in his arms. And this basically, I guess, begins the fall of the empire, right?
It's the first big like strike in the side of the empire. No, so we have Rislav. I'm pretty sure he marries the daughter of the king of Kvatch, and they sort of make an alliance. And basically, Rislav turns out to be quite the tactician, and basically thwarts the Elysian forces by, you know, tricking them and raining down arrows on them and killing them all. And Emperor Gorius gets really, really mad, understandably, because he wants to try and, like, you know, smite them for not succumbing to the Elysian Order, and obviously also killing a priest. So the Kelovian estates by this kind of get emboldened by Rislav, and then Rislav, along with, you know, Kvatch and, you know, suppose probably Anvil and other places that kind of aren't, like, Such is probably there,
yeah.
And stuff like that. But and Coral. But so they all basically form kind of a, what do you call, like a block of kingdoms that are sort of have an alliance based on a mutual, like, we don't want to be ruled by the empire.
Yeah, well, that's the thing. It's not just that he beat back the empire, but it's the way he did it as well. It was such a kind of, you know, like spitting in the face of the emperor, you know, like the Emperor Gorius rides up to Skingrad and Rislav just looks over the battlements and says, sorry, we don't have enough room to accommodate all of you. and tells him to write next time, you know. And it's like, obviously, if you say that to an emperor in front of his army, it's just the biggest insult. And, you know, it's like, at that point, all of the Clovian kings, you know, they're thinking about their own power, and, you know, obviously they have an alliance, but it's like, yeah, well, if he's not afraid of the empire, we're not going to be afraid of them either. You know, and they don't want some theocracy to basically say, no, forget being a king of your own holding. We have one god, and he's, you know, like, they're paramount, and our emperor, like, you know, speaks for the god. And it's like, no, they don't want that. They like their kind of feudal society where they have their own kingdoms and their own holdings. And that's the thing about the culture. It's so different over in the west of Cyrodiil.
Yeah.
I
was going to say, and it's not just an alliance between the Clovians. I mean, everyone gets involved, right? Like the Dereni. In High Rock basically start pushing out like Elysian influence. And even Skyrim, right? When you have High King Hoag, Mercula, of course, killer of elves. And they basically, so Dereni outlaws the Elysian reform in High Rock, mounts incursions into Imperial territory, and then Skyrim under King Mercula joins in this resistance. The Dereni push back the Elysians eventually. And then there's, of course, the Battle of Glenumbria Moors, which goes down.
Well, that's the thing. You're drawing lines in the sand. You know, the Elysian Order specifically saying, you know, like, obviously they had to fight back against the elves initially in creating the empire, but really drawing the line in the sand and then massacring the Aelids, you know, all this time after Elysia's death. You're going to expect some backlash. So you've got backlash from the Clovians who just want to do their own thing. Mm. But then, you know, when all this massacre of the Aelids happens, Loriar and Dainar, he goes for the Dereni, you know, they're still fairly powerful elves. And he's basically, you know, is going to help them take down the empire that just came and massacred his people. And he will know them pretty well.
And the elves got quite, they lost a lot of their power as well in High Rock. Like their forces got pretty depleted from battling the Elysians. And this Mercula king, he gets killed as well in that Battle of Glenumbria Moors.
Yeah. Yeah, it's interesting. I was just a little deviation I was just going to say before, but I like to think of, like, the Clovians as, like, the envisioning themselves as sort of the inheritors of the... Not inheritors of, but the spiritual continuation of Elysia's empire and the time of Belhaza and stuff. And like, you'll actually find there's a lot of minotaurs in that Gold Coast region and stuff like that as well. So I can imagine sort of, you know, the Eight Divines and the Clovian and the minotaurs and sort of what the empire was before the Elysian Order co-opted it, that culturally they were sort of like that and didn't like this new rising empire of fanatical zealots.
Well, you mentioned Muruk's visions, but you know, it really doesn't seem like the kind of thing Elysia would say to some random Imgur in the middle of Valenwood's forest. It's like, it seems very counterintuitive. And as you said, they become such a different power after the Elysian Order manifests.
Yeah.
So I almost imagine Muruk as some Imgur who, you know, like we talked about it on our lesser known races, the Imgur, they tend to mimic the high elves and they kind of like are fascinated by the elves. You almost imagine he's one who's just, you know, he just completely contrarian, goes against it and just didn't like that aspect. And
do you see a little bit of yourself in him? A little bit of a contrarian aspect?
A little bit. But I wouldn't go and slaughter a bunch of people because of it.
No. And it's quite interesting that he's so xenophobic being an Imgur. You know what I mean? Like,
wait. Yeah, let's just clarify. I'm a contrarian, not a xenophobe.
Oh yeah, that's what I
that's
mean.
That's what we're getting at.
Our meme here is that Drew is a contrarian for the sake of being contrarian. Like, that's the meme. That's the meme. Yeah. But anyway, so yeah, it is interesting. Like being an Imgur, you know, like being so anti-elf. But then he was also anti other things like minotaurs and stuff. Like they were part of, I guess, the original Elysian. Empire in the sense that they served like they had a more significant role until they were all pushed out.
Yeah, started being calling monsters and stuff.
There's a theory that, you know, like I think the Elysian Order kind of insinuated that it was more of it was large Aelid hordes that pushed back against the Minotaurs, but it seems actually more like it's the Elysian Order that didn't want Minotaurs involved.
Isn't there that stone that's called the Belhaza Stone, where there's a bunch of people with spears attacking like a Minotaur, and people are talking about whether that could... Some people interpret it as Aelids, or others interpret it as Elysian order spears.
I always did interpret it as Elysians pushing them out, but open up.
Well, you imagine a hoplite, as we talked about before, you know, the spear-wielding foot soldiers.
Let's just check, though, sort of with a timeline kind of thing, because the Elysian doctrines are enforced 361, so that's kind of happening around that time. When does Elysia die? 266. So, but assuming, you know, that's at the end of her bed, like she didn't just give birth to Belhaza then, so Belhaza would have probably been born sometime between 243 and 266. Like, let's just say, for sake of argument, he's 20. So 20 at 66, 40 at 86, and then another. It's kind of too. I don't think he would have lived. It depends if the Minotaur's lifespan works differently. I don't think Belhaza would have necessarily been around at the time of the Elysian doctrines. But perhaps 361 is when they are, you know, canonically enforced. Whereas, you know, in the years prior, there could have been pressure. Like, maybe he was just killed by a bunch of Elysian zealots who weren't quite. You know, they haven't got the doctrines enforced yet.
Well, it's always going to be a bit controversial when you've got this big human rebellion and then essentially your monarchy is half bull, you know, as opposed to human. It's an interesting thing to have right at the forefront of your empire.
Yeah. You know? It's interesting. So back to the Battle of Glenumbria Moors, it's interesting that that is cited as like the most disastrous sort of downfall for the Elysians, because it's the sort of combination of Skyrim, High Rock, and the Clovian Estates, and even like Aelid's, like, you know, Lelorian Dianar, who joins up with the Dureni to all together fight against the Elysian Order and drive him out of High Rock. Though, centuries later, they come back to High Rock. So there's Empress Hestra, who she is involved with defeating the Grey Host for the first time. And there goes Michael.
This is about the fourth time we've lost Michael due to internet issues. Do we just keep going, slog through, or should we pause?
Okay, we just lost Michael. He's officially dead. We've been losing him all
Please
podcast.
Please comment Fs to pay your respects to our fallen Farge Muppet.
Yeah, internet connection failed him, so we're gonna continue on in his honor. So let's keep going. So we just started talking about Empress Hestra. So it's funny that, you know, the Battle of Glenumbria Moors was the attempt of the Elysian Order to annex High Rock, and it failed, and they sort of consider that like part of the downfall of the Elysian Empire. But maybe it just soured their opinion to everyone else. But the Elysian Order, we have Empress Hestra come in. It's like a nearly not quite a it's like quite a few centuries later. So it's
1029 is the earliest time we know she's active. So this is like 500 years or more since the whole ordeal between Gorius and Rislav and stuff like that. So it's very bizarre how the Elysians have been and what even happens during a lot of this time.
Like I've said this before, but it's one of those things where it's like you could take the entire... It's the first era is super cool, but it's really bloated with time. You could compress it down into, you could probably compress it even down into like 1500 years, all of it.
I mean, we're going to talk about it a lot after this bit on Hestra, but you have 1008 years that essentially goes nowhere. And there's a lot of really cool lore to justify it, but you can tell it's all justifying something very weird.
So there's this whole, like, the Grey Host, which is this big evil kind of vampire / werewolf group that sort of discussed more in the Greymoor DLC. But so Empress Hestra deposed King Styrich, who was a vampire of Verkarth. And also, so she basically admits High Rock into the Empire. So High Rock, after the Battle of Glenumbria Moors years later, just sort of, okay, we'll join, kind of. The Reach also, Empress Hestra is the same one who was fighting Phelan, the Red Eagle of the Reachmen and his forces and so on. So she was sort of up there. So if you imagine the Elysian Empire at this time, it's kind of like not the West, because it's just the sort of Nibene region, probably reasonably far south, like I'd imagine down to Leyland kind of thing. So it's kind of like this thin strip that kind of goes all the way up and then sort of across the Dragontail Mountain regions and then up into High Rock. So it's like this kind of
line in the sand, a snake of empire. Because they do, their influence is all the way down to Topol Bay, because obviously we have another conflict that Hestra deals with Red Brahmin coming up soon after. So it seems like, for, you know, from what we do know about Hestra, she had a lot of, she was dealing with a few enemies on a lot of fronts and did pretty well with it.
Yeah, I do, I think there is... There, I'm just trying to find if she's the Kryn, got the Kryn. Yes, okay, I find this really cringe ESO lore. I really hate it. And it's just this. When the Empress Hestra led her legions in harrying the Vampire King and his Grey Host into Western Hammerfell, it said so she did while riding a great flame Atronach bear mount called Fiery Ursula.
Ooh. Okay, yeah. I'll be honest, I didn't know anything about this, the Greymoor editions yet. I haven't really done my research into that, so that's a... That's an interesting thing to put in.
That's pretty,
really trying to canonize those mounts.
Yeah. But still, I guess we should also mention that the powerful class of runestone called Hestra Stones found in Cyrodiil. Mm. But yeah, look, there's Hestra's one of the only others we know of. I think there's Gorias, Hestra, Belhaza, and obviously Alicia. Then we'll sort of start talking about it now. So basically, like, you know, she got Hyrok, Hestra got Hyrok, time goes on. Now, if we're going back to the Elysian Order, they're still quite zealots at this point because there's this sort of secret group of the Elysian Order called the Marakadi Selectives, named after Marok. And they basically use they dance on the tower and they use the Staff of Towers, all of this metaphysical mumbo jumbo essentially, and they basically, in short, caused the largest dragon break ever in history. And the reason for doing this is because, being the anti-elven zealots they are, is that they wanted to excise all of the elven elements from Akatosh, so they didn't want it to be associated with Auriel and completely. Also, we don't know how successful, I guess, that was, if that actually came into fruition, if you can truly consider Akatosh and Auriel separate beings, or rather they just screwed stuff up and
yeah, they just break time for 1,008 years. And the thing is with dragon breaks is that, you know, I mentioned before about how it kind of is a way to reconcile huge leaps in time, you know, so from the 12th century of the first era all the way through to the 22nd or 23rd century, so over a, you know, as I said, over 1,000 years, and you try to it makes sense that when there's a dragon break going on, so you've broken the linear passage of time, it's really hard to get any concrete sources telling about what happened there. And there's the source which I'll bring up in a minute where a lot of interviews with people who existed in that time, it says they spoke sideways, which if you think about it, it's like when time has stopped moving forward, it's as if their words aren't really going anywhere or meaning. So you think about it like sideways on a timeline, it's up and down on a timeline rather than things actually being said and done that actually mean anything, because it's just this middle dawn where the only way to gauge the passage of time is to watch these 8 stars fall from the sky over the span of it.
Yeah.
It's very bizarre.
And it's interesting to, like, there's some interesting lore here about the Amulet of Kings too. And basically that it was through the amulet, I'm pretty sure from the Elder Council, you know, consulting the Amulet of Kings, because the Amulet of Kings actually contains the souls of all past emperors. And basically they sort of consulted it to sort of figure out, kind of try and find out what amount of time had actually passed in this sort of new linear version. But obviously lots of crazy stuff happened. Like you had like this, I think it's you're going to pull up the source in a second anyway on the dragon, where were you when the dragon broke?
Mm-hmm.
But yeah. The tales of Shor-El, the emperor who took the empire to the stars, or, and Cyrodiil was an egg or something.
This gets very weird. But I mean, like, that's one thing I'll say is it's very pervasive in all of imperial history, is that, you know, I mentioned it at the beginning of the podcast, but there is a lot of focus on Akatosh and the dragon elements, but Shor, aka Shazar, aka Lorcan, is really deeply ingrained in everything about the empires, because the Amulet of Kings is made from a drop of his own blood, you know, and all of their souls go there, and so you've got literally Shor-El existing as an emperor as well.
Yeah.
And, you know, like it's a very half-baked theory, which I need to focus on more, but there's this idea that, you know, he's the trickster god, he's very chaotic in nature, and a lot of this anti-elven aspects of the Empire, you can, if you attach it to Shaw, it makes a lot of sense because his realm is Mundus. His people are mortals. Whereas you know with elves, a lot of the time they're looking towards the heavens. They're thinking back to Aetherius.
Yeah.
You know? And it's like, that's not what Lorcan wants.
And yeah, because he wants to kind of solidify the idea of Mundus. And the way he can do that is getting rid of this elven idea. In the same way that the elves want to get rid of man, as if you were to buy into those like ultimate Thalmor goals, and they want to erase the idea of, or any champions of man, because they solidify the idea of mortality because they like it. Because, and you know, it's kind of cool, like you're saying, like Lorcan's kind of trick, he wants to keep it going that way, so that, you know, and yeah, you just have
I'm gonna get the exact quote here. I don't want to say too much on this, where were you when the dragon broke, but yeah. I think this is it. According to Hestra, Cyrodiil became an empire across the stars. According to Shor-El, Cyrodiil became an egg. So most say something in a language they can only speak sideways. It's like, how do we begin to interpret this?
Yeah. Yeah, that's the line. So the Amulet of Kings, however, with its oversoul of emperors, can speak of it at length. But even they were confused. But so it seems that, yeah, it was the stars. Then that's how they counted the 1,008.
And when the Moth Priests try to attune the scrolls to the timeless time, their glyphs disappear. So even these really wise keepers, these Moth Priests, can't get a read on this huge span of time.
Yeah.
That's, you know, a third of the First Era.
And there is some cool lore that comes of it. Like, there was some in the Black Books video, there were some allusions between Manimarco and he in this same book, Where Were You When the Dragon Broke, claimed that that he learned his great mystery during the dragon break and stuff like that, and so maybe that's like leading into some of his like powers later on. But basically this is a giant cope. Like, I see, as far as lore goes, I even said this in the greatest fictional universe thing, like, it is a giant cope. Dragon breaks are not the best written things, they're kind of contrived, but I do like the idea behind them is to sort of keep going the unreliable narrator and like player interpretation kind of thing. So I do like the idea behind them, but they're very much to, like, you know, cope with a game world where people make differing choices. And
yeah, I think it's much cooler than simply saying, oh, these are just games, ignore that, but this is what actually happened, and kind of making everything you did as a player obsolete after you finish the game. It is a cool idea. And you know what's interesting as well is the Khajiit, because they only care about the passage of the moons, which supposedly were operating pretty much as normal during this time, so they seem to have a kind of grounded perspective in this. And it's as you just said about solidifying the player's choices, it's like, you know, there's a quote from the main during the time who says, the second time the big walker was used, which is the Numidium, was in Daggerfall, or was it Sentinel, or was it Wayrest, or was it in all three places at once? So it's like, it's cool to, even though they are very contrived, it is cool to have these calamities in the lore and the history that kind of, yeah, it guarantees that whatever you do when you play these games, it's not for nothing. It does kind of mean something. So dragon breaks are interesting in that sense, but they also make understanding the Elysian Empire very difficult, because we talk about the gradual decline of the Elysian Empire in the 5th century of the First Era, and now we're talking about the year 2230 or whatever.
Yes,
the Elysian Order's still doing their thing, and this all happens.
Well, that's why when it kind of, so I guess we're kind of getting to the downfall. That's kind of why, like, the dragon breaks such a kind of mess of time in between just events that are so far away. If the Elysian Order only got going at, what was it, 361 or something, and then their downfall, supposedly the start of their downfall in like 420 or whatever it is for the Glenumbria Moors, you've got a long, long, long way until it gets to, the Dragon Break ends 2208, I think.
Yes.
Yep. Yeah. And then you've got, and then soon after, I'll just pull up the timeline again. Yeah, so it's in the year 2305. So still a proper, like, solid, like,
yeah.
I feel like
it's nearly a century.
Ultimately, it's not well thought through, I think, the Elysian Empire in terms of timescale. I think they should have been gone way earlier or something. Or that whole dragon break could be like, you know what I mean? There's just so much time here can be condensed. Like, they just pass a century, like, that means nothing. Or like two, you know what I mean? Like,
yeah. So, like, then it kind of leads into this War of Righteousness.
Yes.
Which is essentially the official end, I guess, you know, as far as this...
It's essentially this bloated theocracy sort of cannibalizes itself in power struggles and all kinds of stuff. High Rock had only, what is that, 16 years prior to the War of Righteousness had seceded. They basically just... They just die. They go away. They cannibalize themselves. And it's interesting to speculate because we have so little information about the emperors of this time. But what's happened to the dragon blood at this time? Maybe the War of Righteousness itself sort of actually erupted, because apparently it's a decade-long conflict, actually erupted out of sort of, like you know, a political side, like, oh no, I'm ordained by God. No, this one's ordained by God, and they're trying to sort of, and maybe the dragon blood has actually kind of faded, and maybe no one can light the dragon fires, and then they're trying to keep it together, and then...
Yeah, well, that's the thing, is it essentially fades and we don't have a great deal of information for approximately 300 or 400 years, which will be our next topic.
Yeah.
We will be casting some restoration magic on Michael, bring him back for that.
Yeah.
It's the Riemann dynasty is what comes next and kind of... Is there any information about what goes on between that time?
Not really.
Yeah.
And not outside of it. And it's interesting because... This is where you get all of the cool Clovian Nibonese lore, because the Clovians could stand sort of resolute like this whole time, like all the way back from Rislav all the way to now. They've sort of stayed by themselves, and it's only when you have, you know, Riemann the First, who will come, which we'll talk about next episode, but he unites the Clovians and the Nibonese, and then, you know, we'll get into that again later. But ultimately, the Elysian Empire is... just it kind of sucks for most of the part of it, I think. Like
mess, but a really cool mess.
Yeah, I hate it. Kind of sucks what happens to it with the Elysian Order stuff. My favorite part when I hear Elysian Empire, I love those like first like 100 or so years, like, or just post Elysia, before the Elysian doctrines, or even around the time where they're being established. Like, if that was a game setting in the first era, like, imagine if you could play, like, you know Dragon Age Origins, you know, that sort of like how you can have different starting points. Imagine if you could play as, like, you know, a Need, an Aeliad, or maybe a Minotaur or something, and then there's like three origins stuff, and it's around the time when the Elysian Order is getting traction. And
well, I think they actually have a lot of license to be creative when it comes to this, because I mean, like, the statue of Morehouse in the Imperial City is a perfect example. That I'm not sure if there is a canon reason for the depiction, or if you have any theories, but Morehouse is depicted as just a human. He's depicted as a man, and the way I've always interpreted that, I'm not sure exactly when it was erected, but it's kind of like how the Elysian Order got rid of the elves, and there's theories that they didn't like the Minotaurs being involved. It's almost like they've retconned some of their own history to make it very human, you know? And so if they were to go back and make a game in the early First Era, they could have license to show it the way it truly was, not the way it was documented.
Yeah, it's kind of like how, you know, like the stories of King Arthur and the Britons are like written much later, but they were all written as if they had the technology of that time. So it's the sort of same way, like when you see the statue of the slave queen Elysia, and she's sort of in this kind of dress that kind of looks a little bit like... You know what I mean? Like more medieval.
Yeah, kind of modern noble attire. Yeah,
whereas,
the kind of people who'd be walking around in the Imperial City at the time.
Yeah, but then there's the Greymoor expansion statue, which sort of canonized the fan depiction, which I really love, but which is her with like the big horns, and it looks far more ancient and sort of mysterious and stuff like that. So that's what I always imagine, just because of things like hoplites and stuff. Like, it'll be interesting to try and like work out, and I guess it's just too much conjecture, but to figure out when they established like... beyond hoplite kind of stuff, like when they made the technological transition, I guess. You know,
I think the King Arthur parallel is kind of perfect, because, you know, with King Arthur you've got the French interpretation, you've got the Welsh origins, you've got the idea that did he actually ever exist, or is he just an amalgamation of all of the early folk tales of the of the Britons? And it's like and he's depicted in modern set. I mean, like, I never saw it, but there's that modern interpretation of King Arthur. And it's like, he's just this cultural hero that endures all time because it just gets adapted.
I love that movie. You should really watch it. It's not like
I should.
Not every bit's best, but you'd probably enjoy it. That's kind of we'll get derailed if we talk about that. But but like the thing to add there too is like for the King Arthur example, it's like, you know, the first writers and stuff about it are sort of like, what, like 500-600 years kind of difference in time or something like that. It's like, this is thousands of years in retrospect. Like even by the time of the Roman Empire, well, you're already looking at, what is it? When is the Roman Empire exactly? 700. So you're looking at like close to 400 years since the end of the empire. And then that end of the Elysian Empire was so disconnected from the beginning, which was thousands of years prior. Like you're dealing with some pretty heavy myth, like ages, and a lot of stuff can sort of, history can be changed. But I think that pretty much sums up the Elysian Empire. So thank you guys for watching. We lost a brother on the way, but you know, this law business is tough stuff. You know, some you're bound to lose a comrade or two along the way as you go.
The law must go on.
All right. Well, we will be back to nerd out with you again next time. We'll see you later.